I was asked by Jennifer and Jody to talk about the environmental health impacts of urban transport in India and how we might put in place policies to move us toward, more environmentally benign and equitable modes of, modes of urban transport. And what I'm going to do, first of all, is talk very quickly about the rapid motorization that has been happening in India and the many associated impacts. And I will then argue that whereas the characteristics of the context, the realities of the context, argue for an urban transport policy that essentially focuses on accessibility, we have tragically an urban transport policy, as indeed Professor Bannister argued, that does the precise opposite, right? That is motor vehicle centered, that privileges motor vehicles and the minority of Indians that can own and use motor vehicles, while not merely ignoring, but in fact actively discriminating against the vast majority who have no choice but to walk. And I will discuss very briefly why there is this massive gap between the needs of the context and policy, and suggest some strategies for what we might do to bridge that gap. So, very quickly, I'll start with this. This shows the very rapid growth in motor vehicle numbers globally. We are sitting at around 800 or so million motor vehicles globally, and it is estimated that we'll go up to about 1.3 billion motor vehicles by 2030, and most of that growth is going to be happening in low-income countries, such as India and China, so that whereas the low-income countries now account for about 35% of the global motor vehicle population, are likely to account for about half the motor vehicle population globally by about 2040. Next slide, please. And this graphic, which is taken from a recent issue of The Economist magazine, in fact contrasts the motor vehicle sales, in fact more precisely passenger motor vehicle sales in the so-called BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, against the U.S. And you can sort of see why, you had the kind of collapse in the automobile industry in the U.S. in around 2008. Motor vehicle sales in the U.S. have essentially saturated and, in fact, came down. And in the meanwhile, of course, motor vehicle sales have been skyrocketing in Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And it's important to point out that this does not include motorized two-wheel vehicles, scooters, motorcycles, and mopeds, which, as I will show you very shortly, account for about 70% of the motor vehicle fleet in India. Next slide. This shows the very rapid growth in motor vehicle numbers and motor vehicle activity in India. Especially since 1980, motor vehicle numbers have been doubling, believe it or not, every 6 years or thereabouts. And while car sales recently have been increasingly more rapidly, have been increasing more rapidly than the sales of two-wheelers, by which I mean motorcycles, mopeds, and scooters, account for about 70% of the motor vehicle fleet in India, and that is represented by the red wedge there. Next slide, please. Now, of course, this, as Professor Bannister pointed out, motorization, of course, has provided mobility for millions of people, in fact, contributes to the economy, it contributes to employment, the development of technological skills, and so forth, but along with rapid motorization has come a wide range of very serious adverse impacts of various kinds. And perhaps the most important from a health and welfare standpoint is deaths and injuries that result from road traffic accidents. And there are two points I want to make in relation to this issue. The first is that the most vulnerable road users, pedestrians and cyclists, who in fact contribute the least to traffic fatalities and indeed other urban transport impacts, are by far the most adversely affected by road traffic fatalities and injuries, as you can see in the left portion of this table. The second important point to make is that to the extent that any attention is paid to this issue, and by the way, in India, road traffic fatalities increased from 15,000 in 1971 to over 100,000 now. And, you know, as Professor Bannister said, the global figure is 1.2 million. So India alone accounts for very nearly 10% of road traffic fatalities. To the extent that attention is paid to this issue, for each road traffic fatality, it is estimated in India that you have 20 to 30 very serious road traffic injuries and up, and as many as 50 to 70 road traffic, minor road traffic injuries. Now, tragic as road traffic fatalities are, road traffic injuries are at least as serious, if not more serious, because they economically devastate families for generations and might well account for a much larger number of life years lost, certainly quality life years lost, than traffic fatalities. Next slide, please. And this, of course, repeats a point that Professor Bannister made. Today, road traffic injuries are the ninth most important cause of deaths globally due to all causes. It is estimated that in 2030, road traffic injuries are going to cause more deaths than all cancers. I mean, you know, it's going to be number five on the list, and that's in 2030. And that's how serious this is as a public health issue. Next slide. And whereas the road traffic fatality rate per 100,000 population has, you know, has been going down, in fact, or essentially stabilized in this part of the world, it continues to go up in countries like India and China. Next slide. Now, I want to talk about a few other impacts very quickly. Vehicle emissions, of course, a major issue, and Professor Bannister talked about particulates. Vehicle emissions are a major contributor to the poor and rapidly deteriorating air quality situation in Indian cities. And this graphic shows the PM10 levels over a six-year period. A colleague of mine at UBC generated this data at a major traffic intersection in Delhi. Now, I should point out that all sorts of technological solutions have been thrown at this problem. You know, significantly improved fuel quality, significantly enhanced vehicle emission standards. Very few people might know this, but Delhi perhaps has the largest, you know, fleet of public vehicles running on compressed natural gas. And that happened. Compressed natural gas was essentially implemented over a 2 or 3 year period from around 2000 or so. And the point of this graphic is this, quite simply. Notwithstanding all of these technological solutions that have been thrown at this problem, look at PM10 levels at this major traffic intersection, you know, which is why I say, is it, you know, this essentially amounts to just shifting the deck chairs. There's no discernible trend in PM10 at this major traffic intersection. Next slide. This again repeats a point that Professor Bannister made. Energy consumption in the road transport sector, which depends predominantly on petroleum, is increasing the most rapidly of all sectors globally and is increasing more rapidly in countries like India and China relative to the OECD. And so that by 2030, the non-OECD countries are expected to account for nearly 50% of energy consumption in road transport, with very profound implications for energy security and climate change. Yes, next slide, please. Now, but perhaps the most important urban transport impact is the loss of accessibility, particularly for pedestrians. And this is not merely because the most vulnerable road users are adversely affected, but also because the loss of accessibility contributes to and exacerbates other urban and urban transport impacts. And why is that? That is because the more accessibility is compromised, the more walking, cycling, and public transit become unviable, the more inevitable motor vehicle activity becomes, leading to a vicious circle of ever more motor vehicle activity, congestion, air pollution, energy consumption, and other impacts. And it's important to point out that this is not merely, accessibility loss is happening not merely because of rapidly increasing motor vehicle activity, but also motor vehicle-centered urban transport planning that privileges, as I said, the minority who own and use cars, and not only ignores but actively discriminates against people who have no choice but to walk and cycle. And of course, this leads to adverse impacts for all, including motor vehicle users. Next slide. So what are we doing in response to this in India? It's more of the same. It's business as usual, conventional urban transport planning, which focuses on building more capacity and doing it in a very bad way, which I'm going to show you very soon by means of some photographs. Trying to reduce congestion over the short term by increasing capacity and, of course, throwing technological solutions at the problem to reduce various impacts on a per vehicle kilometer basis. Next slide. Now, motor vehicle-centered urban transport planning has been shown to be futile and counterproductive even in resource-rich contexts. It's very expensive, but it's futile and counterproductive even in resource-rich contexts such as the USA, which, believe it or not, spends about $350 million every day, day after day, on its highway infrastructure. As this graphic shows, notwithstanding this massive highway building over the last, several decades, congestion continues to increase on urban highways. And this is the fairly recent data from the Texas Transportation Institute. Next slide. And while capacity addition to reduce congestion and so forth is futile and counterproductive even in resource-rich contexts, it is not only futile and counterproductive in countries like India, it's highly undesirable because in the Indian context, given the very high population densities, very high levels of poverty, even in urban areas, it's going to lead to massive accessibility loss, displacement, social disruption. And I want to run through some photographs very quickly to show you the state of affairs in Indian cities today. This is in the computer capital of India, Bangalore. This is the state of the public domain in this supposedly technologically advanced city of Bangalore. And this is on a major arterial. I just took a walk. I mean, I've got hundreds of photographs. I've selected about 15 or 20 for you. And if we can just go through very quickly, open drains. And if you can see, the lamps are in the median for the vehicles, not for the vast majority of Indians who are pedestrians, who have no choice but to be pedestrians. Look at the state of, look at this poor chap struggling with his bicycle. This is what I mean by accessibility loss. Next slide. People frantically trying to cross the road, no pedestrian facilities whatsoever. Next slide. People waiting for a bus. They are waiting on the road. Next slide. And that's what happens when you try to get into and clamber off a bus in India. Next slide. People trying to cross the road. And if you can just go through this very quickly. They get to the middle, they're still stuck there, and then a whole bunch of other people stuck. And this lady took her life into her hands and is trying to frantically make her way through the traffic. Next slide. Look at this poor woman with a load on her head, and she's actually wondering, how the hell am I going to get to the other side of the road? With a child in her arms. And next. This is my hometown of Madras, right? And look at what's been done to smoothen traffic flows for motor vehicles. They have this median that runs all the entire length of this road, absolutely no pedestrian facilities. Next. And this is what people have to do. And this is at 6 o'clock in the morning. They're stuck in the middle. They've somehow made it to the median. They're stuck in the middle. Next. Right here is a major cancer hospital. And these poor rural folk have come there, you know, and they're trying to make their way. And next. They actually have to crawl up. And so this is how we treat people. And we are providing for the very small minority that drives in cars. And I'll just go through this very quickly and finish. Back to the slides. So not only, you know, is accessibility loss a very serious problem because it contributes to and exacerbates other impacts, you know, constantly providing for motor vehicle activity, which is likely to generate even more motor vehicle activity, is very likely to lock us in India into a highly inflexible, vulnerable system, you know, vulnerable to oil supply disruptions and so forth, which will affect all, including motor vehicle users. And the situation in medium-sized cities is of particular concern because motorization and population growth rates are very high in those cities. Yes. Now, so, oops. I'll try and get this done as soon as I can. Right. I think it's important to look at the characteristics of the Indian urban context. It is a context characterized by very high urban densities and very mixed land use, which is in fact the natural advantage of Indian cities, which, by the way, is being actively destroyed by motor vehicle activity and planning for motor vehicle activity, and mass poverty, as a result of which, of course, you get a very large number of, very large share of trips being performed over short and medium distances. About 40% of trips performed over 2.5 kilometers. Next. As a result of which, notwithstanding rapid increases in motor vehicle activity, even in the most motorized Indian city, Delhi, you have a very large proportion of trips, notwithstanding the very bad conditions for pedestrians and cyclists, and public transit, a significant proportion of trips performed by public transit, cycle, and walk. And in Bombay, this is very recent data generated by the World Bank, 53% of all household trips for all purposes are performed on foot, and yet most of the transport investments are focused on this piddly proportion, about 3% or so of all trips performed by personal motor vehicles. And the question then is, okay, we'll just go to the next couple of slides, if we may, and I'll conclude this. I think I will just stay with this slide and conclude with this. The question is, why is it that notwithstanding the characteristics of the Indian context, the needs of the Indian context, the massive mode shares accounted for by pedestrians and cyclists, the potential benefits in terms of energy consumption and road safety and all of this as a result that would flow from providing for pedestrians and cyclists, why is it that the pedestrians in a country of pedestrians is rendered third-class citizens, right? As I say there, despite the context, despite the need, despite the potential. Is it that, and we need to really try and understand why there is this gap. Is it that we do not know? Surely this is not rocket science. Is it that we cannot do it? Is it because of a lack of resources? Or is it because we don't care? Is it a lack of political will? And I don't think so, because in the space of just 3 years, Delhi implemented compressed natural gas at the expense of literally billions of dollars. I think it's a lack of priorities. You know, we just don't give a damn. And I attribute this to what I call the decision maker's car windshield view. The tragedy is that pedestrians, people indeed, do not count because most people who walk don't have a say. The few who have a say just don't walk. They're chauffeured around. You know, India is a country which, again, most people might not know this, in 2008 actually put 10 satellites into space, including a couple for this country, Canada, right? And launched a moon probe. Surely, surely a country that can put a moon, you know, launch a moon probe can build sidewalks for people. So it's not a matter of knowledge or ability or resources, it's just priorities. And I think I will close with that. Thank you very much.